Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. This recording and the festival itself take place on the unceded lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We pay our respects to ancestors and elders, past and present. We hope you enjoy this conversation from our 2021 podcast series.
What a lovely reception. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. It's good to be here. What have you been doing, Margaret, lately?
I've been reading books that have been adapted to the screen and watching movies that have been adapted from books, especially for this. But I think you wanted to start, David always wants to start, with Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Yeah, Picnic at Hanging Rock was such an important film for the Australian film industry, for the revival. It was 1975. There had been some Australian films made in a couple of years prior to that, but none of them had been of really, really high quality, I think it's safe to say. And along came Picnic at Hanging Rock, which of course was adapted from a book by Joan Lindsay, which was completely fictitious, but a lot of people thought it was true. And Peter Weir and the writer Cliff Green, who adapted it for the screen, were faced with some quite major challenges in adapting the book into the film that I'm sure most of you have seen and you know. And the greatest challenge was the ending, because the book ends, and I will read you the last bit. The book ends with Mrs. Appleyard, the headmistress of the school, climbing to the top of the rock and throwing herself off. An eagle hovering high above the golden peaks heard her scream as she ran towards the precipice and jumped. A spider scuttled to safety as the clumsy body went bounding and rolling from rock to rock towards the valley below, until at last the head in the brown hat was impaled on a jutting crag. Well, that was filmed. Peter Weir filmed that, and more than that, he filmed the body being carried back to the college, and it looked terrible. It just was such a downer to end the movie, and so he and his editor Max Lemon devised a way of ending it without that. So what happens in the film, if you know the film, is that there's a shot of Mrs. Appleyard at her desk, and a voiceover says that some days later she was found dead at the foot of the rock. And then the film goes back to the scene of the girls on the rock, that sort of beautiful, ethereal scene with the panpipe music, and it's step printed, which means it sort of stop, go like that. And it ends on a shot of the Anne Louise Lambert character, Miranda, isn't it? Sort of turning back towards the camera, and it freezes that shot, and that's the end of the film. So that was an interesting way of changing the ending of a film, of a book, to make the film sort of more acceptable. And I bored Margaret with this story, and I'm going to bore you with it now. One of the most interesting interviews I ever did was long before the movie show began, was with David Lean, the English director, and Robert Bolt, the famous playwright who had written Man for All Seasons. And Robert Bolt had adapted two books for David Lean, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which became Lawrence of Arabia, and Dr. Zhivago. And we were talking about the difficulties, the problems, the challenges adapting a book into a film, and this is long before TV miniseries, so it had to be a film of a length that was acceptable for cinema audiences. And we got around to talking about The Bridge on the River Kwai, which Robert Bolt didn't write, but which David Lean did direct. Now, I don't know how many of you know, I'm sure you've all seen The Bridge on the River Kwai, but the book of that film, at the end of the book, the bridge does not blow up. And I asked why change the ending. I mean, to change the ending so drastically of a book seemed like a very serious thing to do. And Bolt and Lean both sort of spoke together, and they gave a really interesting proposal, which is that if you're watching a film like The Bridge on the River Kwai for 2.5 hours, expecting that bridge to blow up, and in the end it doesn't, you will go home very frustrated. So they both reckoned that you had to blow up the bridge to keep the audience happy. What works on the printed page doesn't always work on the screen. It's a different medium, obviously. And Bolt's contention was that if you're adapting a book into a film, the best thing you can really hope to do is to capture, be faithful to the spirit of the book, if not the letter and the detail of it. Margaret.
Phew. look, it's interesting that, you know, going back to this film, and I read about it, and apparently Joan Lindsay had a dream. She dreamt this book. And a lot of the comment at the time was that it related to this sort of like the European encounter with the Australian landscape and its buried history, you know, that was there way, way before Europeans ever came. And I think there is an element in that. But what I thought the film did that was interesting was it made it a much more sexual thing. It's St. Valentine's Day. These girls are pubescent. They're climbing this phallic rock into which they're going to disappear. They're all in white, virginal outfits. And I thought it was Peter's interesting. I don't know, I can't remember whether that's such an element in the book, but I think it certainly is an element of the film. Do you agree with me?
I do, yes. I think that was a very deliberate element in making the film.
Yeah. And the only other comment I have to make about that film is that I think it's got the worst wig in the history of the Australian film industry. Mrs. Appleby's wig is atrocious.
There might be a reason for that, was that, you know, she was Rachel Roberts, who plays Mrs. Appleyard, was a last-minute replacement for another British actress called Vivian Merchant, who was supposed to play that part. And they'd actually started making the film. They'd shot all the scenes on the rock before they shot the scenes at the college. And they were expecting Vivian Merchant, who was the wife of Harold Pinter, to arrive in Australia to play this part. And she was ill. And casting Rachel Roberts was absolutely a last-minute thing. And so maybe she was wearing Vivian Merchant's wig.
Maybe. But it was still a bad wig. I've heard that Rachel Roberts was not all that easy on that film. Did you hear that?
Probably not.
Oh, I love gossip. David doesn't.
But the other interesting thing I always think about Picnic at Hanging Rock was that so many people thought it was a real story. They thought it actually happened. And I think one of the reasons that the film was so successful, because in 1975, it ran for months and months and months in Sydney and other capital cities. This was before you had sort of wide openings of films. And people were going back, seeing it again and again, to pick up the clues they thought were there, which would explain the mystery. But there was no explanation.
I never really understood the film.
I'm sorry?
I've never really understood the film.
No?
You know, because it... I mean, it, anyway. I mean, I like my interpretation.
Yes. So...
All right, well, I watched Candy again last night. It's really hard to get a hold of. I had great difficulty getting into iTunes, and it seems to be only available there. And I wanted to see it again because I wanted to be reminded of what a good adaptation that had been. Neil Armfield directing, he co-wrote with Luke Davies, whose book it was, and it was Luke's story, because he was a heroin addict And I don't know whether any of you have seen the film. I think because of the subject matter, a lot of people stayed away from it. And it was always interesting to me that when I read the book, the character of Dan, which is really Luke in the book, he's actually quite hard on. And I think the book is, in a way, his expiation of the relationship he had with this woman that he, you know, drew into the world of heroin and petty crime and just, you know, disgusting stuff. And in the adaptation, it's so moving again because Heath Ledger was cast in the leading role as Dan and Abbie Cornish as Candy. And Heath brings, I think it's one of his really outstanding performances. He brings a vulnerability to that character that is really heart-wrenching, and particularly because of what happened to him later. You can't look at that film now without it just rings your heart. They're all so good. And Neil's direction and choice of music and Danny Cooper's editing is so spot on, and they're all good. Jeffrey Rush is in it, Noni Hazelhurst, Tony Martin. And I looked at it and I thought, you know, because Neil's a friend of mine, it's such a relief when a friend of yours makes a decent, good film and not a bad one. And I actually texted him last night saying, it is so searingly good seeing it again. If I can enthuse you to go and seek it out, I will, because even though it's a tough film, it's just wonderful, I think, in so many ways.
It is a tough film. When you chose this for one of the adaptations, my heart sank a little because it was not a favourite film of mine. I had not read the book, but I went and got the book and read it. And I think there's no doubt that it's a really skillful adaptation from book to screen. And I can't fault the film in terms of Neil Armfield's direction or the performances, but I just don't like it. I mean, it, and maybe this is a flaw in me, that spending a couple of hours with these characters I found so incredibly depressing. I just wanted to go out and watch Singing in the Rain again afterwards.
You see, I found it moving, and
I didn't, you see. I think that's the problem.
I sort of embraced them, and maybe what it is not anything new about drug addiction, but I just thought, because it's so beautifully done, that it actually has a power all its own. And to me, I think of all the films we're going to talk about, this to me is the best adaptation of a book.
As an adaptation, I don't dispute that. I think it is, having just read the book again and then seen the film again, I wouldn't quibble with that at all.
Did you look at the film again?
Yes.
Oh, I'm touched. Because, you know, Luke's gone on. You know, he wrote Lion. He's doing, for which he won a BAFTA. You know, he's doing extremely well internationally. And I'm really pleased with him, for him. Because he started out writing poetry. And, you know, he is actually a very good poet, but he's turned out to be an even more lucrative screenwriter.
All right, well, shall we talk about another film? How about a more recent one? How about The Dry? Now, I'm sure a lot of you have read Jane Harper's novel, and I'm sure a lot of you have seen Robert Connolly's, I think, very fine adaptation of the novel. Again, I think it's quite a faithful adaptation, and I couldn't imagine a better actor than Eric Banner to play the leading role. But I asked Rob Connolly if he would help me out in this and give me a few comments to give to you about the challenges of adapting this book. Rob points out that detective films, mystery films, is not a genre that Australian filmmakers often do, very rarely, in fact. They depend on intricate plotting, and for the most part, television is very well respected for that kind of detective series, as we know, especially in Scandinavia, but a lot of English as well. So Rob said that his challenge was how could the adaptation transcend the plotting and the much-loved tropes of genre television? And he said specific questions kept coming up about the character landscape. How many characters do you need to be suspects to maintain tension for an audience? When do you let the audience know the character is innocent, or a character is innocent? We battled with this, he said, right through the edit of the film. Interestingly, again, he should talk about the edit. How many films the narrative is altered, modified in the editing process?
I'm married an editor, and I never understood what he did.
He says here, and this is interesting, Robert Connolly, the director of The Dry, says, I've increasingly developed the approach that a film is written three times, on the page, during the filming, and in the edit. We didn't crack the plotting on the page. We looked to reshoot some strategic pickups in the edit to help, particularly around the final resolution of the film and the discovery of the solution. The ending was discussed, endings again, you see. The ending was discussed right until the very end of the sound mix. It provides the audience with an emotional resolution, a cathartic end point for Falk, but it avoids the trapping of the more typical retribution style resolution. We had to defend this approach right until the end. So I think all of that's interesting. I mean, this whole idea that you write a film three times.
I think, well, I've come to learn that, you know, the editing process is, you know, it's like making the final shape.
Yeah.
And how significant it can be.
Yeah.
Look, I actually, I'm one of the few people that, I'm a bit ho-hum about The Dry as a book. When I read it, I thought it was, you know, a really fine achievement by Jane Harper, but there was always a but for me. I felt there was a hole at the end of it that didn't quite gel together. And while I think that the film is really well made, it's for me it's still got that hole at the end. So I don't know that they were particularly able to fill it, to my satisfaction anyway. And Eric Banner is far too bronzed and handsome to play the central character, who's got really pale skin and red hair, from what I remember. It's not a film that meant a lot to me, but what it did was mean a lot to Australian audiences and a lot to the Australian film industry, because it did so well at the box office in this terrible year for Australian film culture. So, I mean, I think it's up to 20 million now. It's overtaken Priscilla. So it's done extraordinarily well.
Yeah,
and it goes to show how important it is for Australians to pick up the right to remake their successful novels. Because a lot of the time, I remember Sandra Levy saying to me that, you know, if we did write a successful book in this country, you know, overseas snapped up the rights. you only have to look at Leanne Moriarty these days, you know, she's riding high. But, you know, and for that I'm really grateful and I'm really happy that it's done so well in this country.
Your comments on the book, forgive me if I'm wrong about this, but the genre of detective fiction is not your favourite genre anyway, is it?
Yes.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Really?
Well, no, of course.
Not like me, because that's all I read.
Oh, no, I don't just read crime thrillers. But, you know, I mean, Harlan Coben's one of my favourites. He's so violent. It's wonderful. The film, we each sort of chose three films, and it was actually quite hard to select because there have been quite a few of them. And I just chose the ones I loved, and the one that I really loved of recent years was Breath, Simon Baker's debut as a feature director, based on the book by Tim Winton, and I actually thought this was a very interesting twist on an adaptation, because if you've read Tim Winton's book, you'll remember that this is the central character, Pikelet, writing in middle age, looking back on those years. And even though that is an element of the film, because Tim Winton actually voices the reminiscent, it's really told in the film as an immediate coming of age story. And what I thought was interesting is that there is in the book there's that tinge of, and it's more than regret, it's almost resentment that he was corrupted as a young boy, and it has affected the rest of his life. And that's not such a presence in the film. I thought it was really beautifully acted. Those two kids were amazing. They're really good surfers in their own right. I thought the surfing sequences were some of the best I'd ever seen. And I thought Simon Baker really did well to perform in it and direct it. He adapted it with Tim Winton and Gerard Lee, and I'll wait to hear what David thinks about it, because there is another element there that I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
Or do you want me to talk about it now?
Talk about it now.
Well, I don't know whether I'm telling tales out of school, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
There is a scene in the film, I don't know whether how many of you have seen it, it's really well worthwhile, where Elizabeth Debicki plays the Sando, played by Simon Baker's wife, and she's a former champion skier who's had an accident and can't ski anymore, and so there's a bitterness in her, and Pikelet has an affair with her. And this is, you know, a 20, 30-year-old woman, and he's a 15-year-old adolescent. And there is a scene in it with, how do you describe it? You know, autoerotic asphyxiation, where she is, bag over her head and to climax. And Gerard actually wanted that taken out of the film. And I'm inclined to agree with him. I don't actually think that was quite necessary. I mean, maybe that was the thing that pushed Pikelet over the edge, I don't know. But I mean, the guilt of having that relationship with the wife of this man that had, you know, really mentored them as far as, you know, being brave about their surfing and, you know, taking them surfing and pushing them to more and more dangerous stunts on out at sea. But I mean, it's a query. It's a query. Mm.
It is a challenging scene in the film, I think. I basically totally agree with you on breath.
I'm not used to this, David. Really.
Come on, we agreed more than we didn't agree. People don't believe that, but it's true. Again, I think this is an exemplary adaptation. I think Simon Baker and his team did a fantastic job, and Tim Winton did a fantastic job in bringing that book to the screen as beautifully as they did. And it's in sharp contrast with the other Tim Winton book that came to our cinemas and went very quickly this year, Dirt Music. Did you see Dirt Music?
No, I didn't.
It was terrible.
I heard.
And one of the reasons it was terrible, it was completely miscast. I mean, this is a film that was a long time in the works. I mean, at one stage, Heath Ledger was going to be in it, and Nicole Kidman, I think.
I think Philip Noyce was at one stage. Was he interested in directing?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But the film, as we saw it, had an American actor and an English actress playing these quintessential Australian roles, and it never came to life at all. It was just, I don't know if any of you saw it, but I thought it was pretty dismal. And beside that, a really beautiful adaptation like Breath is like a, if I may say, breath of fresh air.
What was the other one? Was it That Eye of the Sky?
That Eye of the Sky,
that was the early Tim Winton
that was
adapted.
That was an earlier one, yeah.
That was
nice.
That was nice. Strange, but nice.
Strange,
yes.
Yeah. That's right. Okay, well, that's Breath. Well, another choice of mine was Ladies in Black.
Oh, I thought that was mine.
No, it wasn't. Well, you have it if you want. Go on.
No, go on. You do it. You do it. Oh, what did I pick?
You picked The Great Gatsby, which is coming up.
No, you did.
All right, well, you... All right, well, I'll do Great Gatsby, if that's what you...
It got very confused. Confusing.
I'm sorry?
All right, go on.
I have to admit that Margaret and I have not... Because we haven't actually seen it. This is the first time we've seen each other for how long?
Quite a while.
More than a year?
Maybe.
Yeah. I think it's the first time.
Well, it was a COVID year. No one went anywhere.
Because I live up in the Blue Mountains and Margaret lives in some godforsaken place where is it?
It's called Sydney.
No, that's just your pied-à-terre. Anyway, we haven't seen each other for more than a year, I think, probably.
Yeah.
And our telephone conversations have been regular, but kind of...
Very rewarding.
Rewarding, yeah. Which possibly, this is I'm trying in a desperate way to explain this, probably explains why she thinks I suggested The Great Gatsby when I'm sure she did. But anyway, it doesn't matter. I think The Great Gatsby is an interesting adaptation. Okay, so it's the only one of the six that we're talking about that's not an Australian book, but it is an Australian film. And of course, it was made entirely in Australia by Baz Luhrmann.
Well, it's written by an Australian.
The screenplay?
Yeah. Oh, no, the book. Madeline St. John is Australian.
The Great Gatsby is written by F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Sorry, sorry, I thought you were doing Ladies in Black.
So this book, which some people, I think, is the great American novel, this was the fourth time it had been filmed. It was filmed in the silent era, not long after it was first written. A version that no longer exists, sadly. You can see the trailer for it, but you can't see the whole film because it's lost. Then it was filmed in the late 1940s with Alan Ladd as Gatsby, and that turned it into a sort of gangster movie, really. And then, famously, in 1974, it was filmed by the English director Jack Clayton with Robert Redford when he was at his most beautiful, I suppose, and Mia Farrow. And it was kind of leaden, that film. It was all sort of beautiful and perfect and deadly dull, really. And it was a big flop. So when Baz Luhrmann decided to give it another go and maybe make the version of The Great Gatsby, I think there are probably a lot of people who thought he was a bit crazy. But I think he did make the version of The Great Gatsby. I think it's certainly very different from the other three films. It's a film which is in many ways quite exhilarating, as Luhrmann, of course, he loves these big party scenes that he films with such expertise. These vast parties, choreographed like musicals. But the performances are really wonderful, I think, in this film. Leonardo DiCaprio as Gatsby, Tobey Maguire as Nick, Carey Mulligan as Daisy, Joel Edgerton as her husband, Tom, Elizabeth Debicki again, even in a Isla Fisher, Jason Clarke. A terrific cast, and everybody is really, really good. It doesn't overcome the artificial elements of the book, because there's very artificial moments in The Great Gatsby. I mean, that whole wasteland concept with the Eye of God, the poster with the Eye of God, which is, of course, directly from the book. But to me, it's by far the most successful version of the book, and it's really quite audacious, I think, in many ways. And a lot of people kind of tended to dismiss it, but I think Baz Luhrmann did a fantastic job. And although this is not a thing that will endear it to everybody, he filmed it in 3D, which is at the time was a process that had a short period of popularity. And he's the only filmmaker, I think, who used 3D really creatively. So if you've ever seen it in 3D, it really has a whole different feel to it.
Did it open Cannes?
Yes.
Because it showed in 3D in Cannes, and I had faulty 3D glasses to watch it. It wasn't funny, David. It was excruciating. And I actually love the book. I think it's this just beautiful little jewel of a book. And I think it's about a lot of things. And so this gaudy, flashy thing vomits at you from the screen. So I really, really hated the film when I first saw it. And I thought it was maybe a bit unfair to judge it from that. And so I came back, when I came back to Australia, I saw it again. And I don't like Baz's treatment of it. I don't at all. I mean, it's flashy and trashy and all those fast edits and special effects. And, you know, I mean, Tobey Maguire has got to be the most boring bloody actor in the world. But the others are good. I think DiCaprio is actually wonderful. Joel is. But this, you know, I just sort of feel that everything is sort of, all the subtleties of that book are lost in the film. And it's about Fitzgerald, you know, being part of that world and actually being fairly contemptuous of it. And it's, you know, I mean, what's changed? But it is a lot about, you know, the old rich sneering at the nouveau rich. The nouveau riche, you know, just becoming richer and richer, while, you know, the poor people in the slag heaps, you know, are marginalised. There's, you know, it was the jazz age, you know, where everybody is hedonistic and hysterical in a way, and I guess Baz got that right. But I just can't bring myself to embrace that film at all. And I did watch it again, and I thought, I mean, just those edits at the start of the film. I mean, he calms down a bit later on, but you know that excessive party. It's so frantic and so gaudy and so overwrought. Anyway, why don't you tell it the way you think it, Margaret?
But that approach to it, to me, sort of matched the sort of jazz age elements of the book and the time in which the book was written. I mean, that seemed to me pretty right.
Do you know, you see, I think Baz is an operatic director. You know,
yeah,
he
I
really
think,
is.
No doubt
you
about
know,
that, yeah.
With Moulin Rouge, you know, for me, I think the best film he's ever made is Romeo and Juliet. But, you know, and it's whether that style suits the basic material, and I personally don't think it does.
Okay. Ladies in Black.
Oh, well, I mean, it's a lovely story, really, that Bruce Beresford was recommended to read this book by Madeline St. John, who was living in London at the time. A strange creature, apparently. Everybody was a bit intimidated by her. They'd all been to Sydney University together, and Clive James had read this book that she'd written, The Women in Black, and recommended it to Bruce. This was 93, I think. And Bruce had been trying to make it ever since, and sort of like, gosh, how many years later? A lot of years later, he finally was able to get it together. He wrote the screenplay with his producer, Sue Milligan, and I think they did such a fabulous job. I mean, and I love the film because it was sort of just about the time that I was going to Sydney University as well. And it was like, it was about that cusp of change in Australia where, you know, women were going to university. You know, you suddenly realised you were amongst the first flush of a lot of women going to university. And this is what, you know, an element in Madeline St. John's story as well. She came from a very wealthy family, so maybe, you know, that was par for the course for her. But, you know, it's sort of about these women in David Jones, or, you know, it's not David Jones, it's Coombs or something in the book, and their lives. And the element of, you know, migrants, European migrants coming to Australia, and, you know, with their different food and their different attitude to life, and really, you know, just sort of like changing us so excitingly. It was really beautifully done.
Yeah, I agree. I think the film certainly perfectly captures that period when Australia was beginning to change because of the influx of migrants.
And it was changing for women too. You know,
yes.
I mean, that was what was...
Absolutely. Again, I spoke to the director and the...
Oh, my goodness. Have done your homework.
Sorry?
You have done your homework.
I've done my homework, yes. Bruce Beresford said... Well, I spoke to Sue Milliken too, the producer, because they wrote the screenplay together. So Bruce said, frankly, because the book is called Women in Black, but he said this was really a very easy book to adapt because the basic structure worked so well when transferred to a film script, and the dialogue in the book was excellent. That's pretty much all Bruce had to say, but Sue said what was a joy in doing an adaptation was the subtlety and complexity with which Madeline St. John had underlaid a simple story of a schoolgirl getting a summer job in a department store in the 1950s. Structurally, the transfer of the story from book to screenplay was quite straightforward, as the novel's light touch lent itself easily to the screen. What revealed itself in the process was the observation on women's aspirations and tolerance of immigrants, which has proved to be as relevant today as when the story took place. Sue Millican goes on to say that wearing her producer hat, one of the difficulties that we had in getting financial support to make the film for so long was the opinion of government funding agencies that the story was not worth doing because, quote, nothing happened, unquote. Yet, of course, the story is full of perceptive observation of people's lives and is delivered with a gentle sense of humour which keeps the reader and also, as it turned out, the movie audience entertained. I think it's interesting that Bruce Beresford, who, as you know, has made quite a large number of films both here and overseas, was so anxious to make this film. He wanted so much to make it. And in the end, because there was so little enthusiasm from the funding bodies to support this project, that he made it without any payment at all up front. And to support himself, he went and made two low-budget films in America. And with the money he got from that, he was able to make Ladies in Black. And the other sad thing, I think, after, though the film was a big success in Australia, it had almost no life overseas at all. It's never been released in England. It's never been released in America. It's strange because...
Well, because, you know, in a way, it's a story that really strikes an Australian chord.
I think it does, yeah.
And it certainly did for me. You sort of think that Madeline St. John was a prickly character, possibly not easy. And it's interesting, you read the book and it's almost like there's a tongue-in-cheek tone through the book, but you know she's really fond of these characters, and that's what's lovely about it. I mean, she's sort of like writing this book nearly a quarter of a century after it was set in 1960, I think, and she left the country and lived in America and then in England, and so she's sort of recreating from memory this moment in Australian history that was, and I think she did it really well. No wonder. And Bruce and Sue wrote a screenplay and, you know, took it to her thinking she was going to tear it to shreds, and she actually, you know, liked it, but unfortunately she died before the film was completed. So
I also think one of the wonderful characters, of many wonderful characters, I think, in this film, is the one played by Noni Hazelhurst. I think her name's Miss Cartwright.
Yeah, something like that.
And there's she plays the sort of elderly woman at the department store who sort of keeps an eye on these younger women. And there's a beautiful scene of her on Christmas Day, or is it New Year's Eve? I can't remember exactly, with her mother. And it speaks so much, says so much about the characters, this character of this woman, without you needing dialogue, without needing a whole lot of exposition, just that one scene of her and her mother alone together celebrating this festive event. It's a very good example of a moment on film that doesn't need dialogue, doesn't need a whole big build-up. It's just there and it's beautiful.
Well, it's also, she represents the women of a generation that missed out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the other element of the book and the film that I think is interesting is men's ineptness about sex, which is really there in both, you know, that's sort of like this naivety almost.
Yeah.
That, you know, I think for some it wasn't true. I think for a lot of people it was.
Yeah.
I've got to look at this because I've got to see whether there's any... Just quickly, have either of you ever convinced the other to change their mind about a movie from strongly recommended to or not, or vice versa?
I can't hear a word you're saying.
Oh.
Oh. No.
I couldn't... I couldn't ever... convinced him about Dancer in the Dark.
No.
Lars von Trier generally, actually.
No.
All right. Oh, and there's another one. I'm sorry, that's only two. Is there an Australian book you would like to see adapted for the big screen? Yeah, there is. Who's that Western Australian writer? The Golden... I can't remember. The Golden Age, yes. I thought that was actually a book that could make a really beautiful film. And I wanted Neil to read it and think about it.
Okay. Neil, they don't know who Neil is.
Neil Armfield, sorry. Have you got a book that you've read that...
Look, I've got very lowbrow taste. I'd like... I hope they make films of the other two Jane Harper novels. I'd like to see that.
Well, they've made one. She's only written one other.
No, she's written two more.
Oh, right. Okay. No. Sorry. Okay.
So, questions. Who was first?
Thanks. Great panel. Just general question about film adaptations in general. Do you feel like screenwriters/directors need to be able to adapt their own perspective on it or own sort of flavour? In particular, like Taika Waititi did with Jojo Rabbit, how the book was completely different to the film in a sense, but it sort of followed the same intricate plot of this book. Do you feel like that sort of like comedic, like from Taika's perspective should be added, or like those sort of flavour that like directors should add?
Look, I think you can get away with a lot. I'm the only person in the world that hated One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest because I loved Ken Kesey's novel and, you know, that perspective of it being in the Indian character's head was so beautiful and it just made, to me, the adaptation so prosaic. The one that I thought worked brilliantly was Howard's End. The adaptation of Howard's End is so beautiful. And I actually read it on the plane going over to Cannes and who was, oh gosh, director.
Director, James Ivory.
James Ivory. You know, it was there and it was sort of like, I just thought you got it right. But I don't know, I mean, I think maybe if you want to make your own film, you know, create your own story. If you're going to adapt a book, as David said earlier, you know, I think you've got to stay true to the spirit of it.
And I think you have to have a lot of chutzpah, like Taika Waititi has, to really stamp your own, and like Baz Luhrmann does in a way.
Yeah, well,
to really stamp your very strong personality onto an existing book, rather than create an original screenplay.
Thank you for your six choices. May I ask your opinion about The Dressmaker?
Ah. Margaret.
I thought that Jocelyn Moorhouse did an amazing job pulling that off, particularly when you lose your handsome hero down a grain silo, you know, two-thirds into the film. I think that was a... I think... when I first saw it, I saw it at a preview, and I went, oh, I don't think Australian audiences are going to go and see that. And of course they went in droves. So I don't know. There's something about Australian audiences that respond to the quirky. You know, it's strange, you know. Priscilla, Muriel's Wedding is another one, you know, that I
But
thought,
Muriel's Wedding is good.
Well, I think the dressmaker was brave as well. And I think, you know...
Yeah. I'm not a fan of the dressmaker, I'm sorry. It's funny, it sort of vaguely belongs to the school of Australian grotesque, which I'm not very fond of. Muriel's Wedding maybe is one example where it works brilliantly. A later film by P.J. Hogan called Mental, it's a complete and utter disaster as far as I'm concerned, and The Dressmaker sort of falls somewhere in between. I found a lot of those smaller characters, marginal characters, so overdrawn and so, I don't know, stupid.
I love Judy Davis in it, though, I must say.
Judy Davis was an exception, and she knows how to make that sort of character work. But I'm sorry, I'm not a fan.
So, David and Margaret, I'd love to know your opinion on the adaptations of the Ned Kelly story we've seen to date, one of which agitated me and the other bitterly disappointed me. So do you think that... what did you think of the... I think the Greg Gore Jordan did the first one and then John Hillcoat, I think, did the second one.
Justin Kurzel.
Yeah, what do you think of those?
Was it Justin Kurzel?
Justin Kurzel. What do you think of those? And do you think that there's an opportunity for a third telling of the story that might...
God help us. Sorry.
You didn't mention one of my favourites, which is Robert Davidson's Tracks, because I thought the adaptation of that was really beautiful.
Yeah, that was good, wasn't it? Okay, you go, Ned Kelly.
Go with Kelly. All right. Look, again, I was not at all a fan of the Justin Kurzel true... Is it true history or true story true of the story Kelly gang based on the Peter Carey book? I can't... It would take far too long to describe the number of reasons why I didn't like it. The earlier Ned Kelly, based on the Robert Drew book directed by Gregor Jordan with Heath Ledger, I did like. I don't think it was flawless, but I thought it was really quite good. And actually, I have a nostalgia for the Mick Jagger version, which I don't think is as bad as a lot of people think it is, but that's another story. But to be perfectly frank, I don't care if I never hear of Ned Kelly again. That's how I feel about that. But I agree with you about Tracks. I thought Tracks was a beautiful adaptation and a lovely film, great film.
And I'm with you on old Ned. I didn't even like Gregor's film. And, you know, he got a British cinematographer. And I think it's such a mistake to do that, you know, because it didn't look like Australia. It looked too blue and too... I hated the look of that film.
Yeah.
Yes.
I recently watched My Brilliant Career again and The Getting of Wisdom. And I think that they're both very fine adaptations of the novels, albeit quite different to the novels. Wondering what you both think.
I like them both very much indeed. I think My Brilliant Career was a trailblazing film. Wasn't the first feature film made by a woman in this country since the 30s. There was a film made in 1975 by a Turkish woman called Aytin Kuyululu, who made a film called The Golden Cage. That was the first feature, but My Brilliant Career was the first sort of mainstream feature. And the work of the producer, Margaret Fink, director, Gillian Armstrong, and of course the amazing performance of Judy Davis. it's again an extraordinarily fine adaptation of the book, I think. And The Getting of Wisdom, too, I like enormously. Again, this is Bruce Beresford making a film, really breaking away, because this was really the first film that Bruce made that was not a comedy. I mean, he made, his first one was The Adventures of Barry McKenzie. Then he made Barry McKenzie Holds His Own, alias Barry McKenzie Pulls It Off.
Those sort of films.
And then he made Don's Party, and then he made The Getting of Wisdom, which is so different from all the others. But it does have Barry Humphries playing the headmaster, and Barry Humphries cast completely against type in this role, and he's terrific in it. I think they're both very good.
And then he went on to do Puberty Blues as well.
He went on to do Puberty Blues, indeed he did. He's very, very talented.
Just one more.
Look, do you think The Dry is a breakthrough for the Australian film industry in that it's this been really successful film, which is really interesting during this period of COVID, but the fact that the story is very specific and very Australian, and yet it has this charismatic leading actor in Eric Bana, that it will translate internationally in a way that other Australian films haven't been able to break through? That was my impression when I saw it. I thought, this is a breakthrough.
Look, I hope it will be. I mean, I don't know about international distribution for The Dry, but I certainly hope it will be. I mean, I think really one of the films we talked tonight was the breakthrough, which was Picnic at Hanging Rock. I mean, that was not only a breakthrough here in Australia, but it was shown all over the world. So we mustn't forget that the place of that film in Australian history is probably the most important Australian film ever, just on that level. But The Dry, yes, look, I'm sure it will be shown widely, but things are still so uncertain with cinemas closed and so on. So I don't know what's going to happen. But it still bothers me that Ladies in Black couldn't find international distribution.
Yeah, but, The Dry is a genre film, and genre is sold everywhere, and so I like its chances.
I think it should do well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
It was really lovely to get together with David again. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.